The valley was hit with another torrential downpour over the weekend, which hasn't been a normal October occurrence in recent years. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll look at where the storm came from and whether El Niño is going to bring us even more powerful storms this fall and winter. Plus, the Center for Arizona Policy marked its 20th anniversary this week. The CAP has been very influential at the state capitol, focusing on issues related to traditional marriage and abortion. But that has also made the organization a lightning rod for criticism. I'll talk with CAP President Kathy Herod about the group's growth and why it continues to be so impactful. Also, there are consistent laments the state doesn't have strong nonpartisan leadership or enough behind-the-scenes people who don't care about getting the credit. The late Jack Feaster was praised for doing that kind of work. A new biography of Feaster tells his story. I'll talk with the author Kathleen Ingley and Feaster's daughter, Suzanne. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, I'll talk with the president of the influential organization, the Center for Arizona Policy, Kathy Herod. Plus, a new biography about the late Jack Feaster has just been published. Feaster is considered one of the unsung heroes of Arizona public policy over the last few decades of the 20th century. We'll talk about a new biography. Also, the Book of Mormon finally opened in the Valley this week. The show has been popular and critically acclaimed, but also controversial. We'll discuss why with a scholar who's editing a collection of writings about the musical. We start today's program with the weather, but we're not just making small talk. The state, including the valley, has been hit hard in the past few days by rain, hail, and possibly funnel clouds. With me for a few minutes to talk about that is Ken Waters, National Weather Service meteorologist. Ken, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
So what's been going on around the state the past few days? Where has this been coming from?
Yeah, well, we've been in kind of a transitioning pattern for October where, the monsoon's over with, but we still have a lot of the moisture out there, and we're getting these low pressure systems off the Southern California coast. It's kind of been pumping up more moisture and also making the atmosphere more unstable. And so we've had hail reports the last several days, and as you mentioned, the funnel clouds. So some pretty unusual weather for October, but it looks like today we're thinking might be about the last day of that.
Well, here's a question I think I can only ask a meteorologist. When I was driving in the West Valley on Sunday on the 101, getting hit by hail, I was thinking to myself, how is it still 75 degrees and I'm getting hailed on?
Yeah, right. Well, you've got colder air aloft, and that's kind of the big thing. You know, when you're moving out of the monsoon, you're getting kind of, as I say, transition into wintertime. So there's more cold air aloft. And that can create more instability in the atmosphere, and you get the possibility when you have the right triggers to get some hailstorms forming up. And so we've had 2 days now in the last week where it's had significant hail in the valley. So not unheard of in October, but I just remind everybody just a few years ago, we had a really big day in October where we had up to 3-inch hail in the Phoenix area.
And if anyone saw the Arizona Republic this morning, the front page had a picture of people up in Flagstaff enjoying snow. So could we expect some snowpack this winter?
Well, we're hopeful. The big thing on our agenda is, of course, El Niño. And all indications are a strong El Niño for this wintertime. And not so much the impact of the snow, but more just the moisture coming in. It's going to increase our chances for getting some good wintertime precipitation events. And, of course, for the higher mountains, that doesn't mean snow. But right now we're thinking likelihood of more of those direct systems coming right off the Pacific into Southern California and then spilling on over into Arizona. So we're hopeful that this is going to be our opportunity to help fill up the reservoirs a bit.
And put this into context for us, Ken. How powerful could this be? And are we, from a standpoint of infrastructure, the standpoint of just the way things are set up around the state, are we set up to be able to deal with very heavy driving rains?
Yeah, this one appears to be pretty much on par with about 1997-98, which is kind of the strongest one that we're aware of. At the very least, it's going to be, looks like maybe within the top two or three El Niños. Yeah. And that we have on recorded history. I have to point out that we don't have a lot of history on El Niño, so there's sample size is really small, but it's definitely on track. We've got the warmer water offshore, And so, you know, as far as being prepared, it's pretty much regular business, I would say. You know, just get the word out on you know, flooding hazards. We've already even had some rescues, I guess, yesterday. Just remind everybody to not try to drive through flowing water, because that can be very problematic. And you know, pay attention to warnings, and you know, keep tuned. So we're going to see how it goes, but it certainly looks very promising for a strong El Nino all through the winter.
So if in fact it is powerful, are we talking, when you say winter, are we talking about January? Could it show up a little bit earlier, and could it actually extend our winter at some point?
I don't know. I probably wouldn't say extend. But what it is basically about a 4 or 5 month period, and really kicking off a lot now, or, you know, November, and on through into early spring, let's say about March or so. And basically what it means is more of a direct hit with those stronger storms coming in off the Pacific. And, of course, that always, you know, brings that chance of flooding. So, something to be concerned about, but it is really pretty much an all winter type event. So it's definitely not just limited to just a month or so.
And Ken, finally, when it comes to El Nino, are we talking year to year? So even if this is a really powerful El Nino and we get a lot of rain, of course, people always have to ask the inevitable drought question, is this going to help with the drought? But also, does it mean anything for future years? Could this just be a 1 year wonder?
Yeah, it is kind of a, well, it's a little complicated. El Nino is basically like 11-year cycle, approximately, where we typically will get these, and it's mostly just a single winter season at a time. So we're not looking for any major impacts for the summertime. You know, I always get the question about how's this going to impact the monsoon. So we don't have a lot of information on that. So gonna have to hang on and see what happens, and you know, watch out, be prepared for a lot of rain potentially.
So just be patient and expect a lot of rain. Okay, Ken Waters, thank you. Ken Waters, National Weather Service meteorologist in Phoenix. Ken, always a pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Earlier this week, the Center for Arizona Policy marked its 20th anniversary. Len Munsell, now the president of Arizona Christian University, was the founder and led the organization for its first decade. The center's mission statement focuses on affirming and protecting religious freedom, the sanctity of human life, and strengthening marriages and families. It has had significant influence at the state capitol, especially among those labeled as conservatives. Critics have said the center has too much influence and pushes for legislation that hurts the perception of Arizona. With me to talk about the Center for Arizona Policy's impact is its president, Kathy Herod. Kathy, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So 20 years, it seems amazing, and I wonder, over the course of 20 years, has the influence grown? Have we seen other organizations pop up across the country based on what the CAP has accomplished?
Well, Center for Arizona Policy is actually part of a loose-based, I would say, Family Policy Council network. There are close to 40 similar organizations around the country. We're all different names. We're not tied together legally or financially. But, you know, we all have similar missions, and that is to stand for life, marriage, and religious freedom. Certainly over the 20 years, we've seen tremendous growth in Center for Arizona Policy, especially from to go back to the mid-90s, when there wasn't much of a voice in the political arena and the public policy world on behalf of foundational principles that we address.
I think people tend to think about the Christian Coalition when they think back a focus on the family, when it seemed like high-efficacy voters tended to be grouped into this. And I wonder, overall, how do you think the Christian conservative movement has changed politics?
Well, hopefully there's been a lot of wisdom added. I think that in the early years, we certainly had some some terrific leaders who had a great heart and compassion for what was going on with our country, for how the family was being under attack, to put it in those terms, but maybe not always that wise to the ways of the political world or in how to communicate our values and our concerns. So I think, you know, for many years, those who were concerned about how government was encroaching on people's lives, what freedom meant, especially religious freedom, the issues of sanctity of human life, that heads were stuck in the sand, to use that term. And then all of a sudden it started, oh, wait a minute, maybe we should pay attention to what's going on in our world and get beyond, in a sense, our ivory towers of our churches and engage in public policy really like we should be doing.
There are some who wonder, though, that politics, for some at its best, is a pretty dirty game. And you wonder, with people who come in with your background, are you influencing that in a certain way, or are you muddying yourself up by getting into that?
Well, I can just say how I try to approach it. I try to have what I would call an above reproach standard, that we be careful, that we conduct ourselves almost a golden rule type of approach, to use that type of a term. That, you know, my background is political, that I've been involved, my undergraduate degree was in government. We called it government, not political science, at University of Texas, and law degree. And so I've done a lot of political work in the past. So I've seen the ugly parts of it, and certainly we've seen that here in Arizona. But we try to stick to the public policy arguments, why, for example, how abortion hurts women, how abortion hurts preborn children, you know, what are reasonable restrictions on abortion so that women have all the information they need to make an informed choice, those types of things. So we try to make sure that we're sticking to the social science data and the public policy arguments and not getting in that dirty politics weeds, to put it that way.
Kathy, when you brought up abortion, I feel like I have to follow up with a question about one law in particular that had some medical professionals, some not all, concerned about when it comes to the reversing abortions. And there are some doctors who feel like the law has put them in a situation where they are having to give out what they consider to be misinformation. And I wonder, is when you consider how strongly you feel about this issue, first of all, how do you feel about that reaction? And secondly, is there a more effective way than how you've chosen to do it in this case?
Well, let's look at what the law actually says. It says that you inform a woman 24 hours before she has an abortion, a number of different factors, but including that the abortion pill may be reversible, but time is of the essence. There's no guarantee. There's no absolutely it's reversible. And here's the facts. A young woman went to Planned Parenthood, took the first abortion pill, went back the next day, said, I really don't want to carry through with this. What can be done? I don't want to have this abortion. Planned Parenthood told her nothing can be done. The young woman was able to see an obstetrician gynecologist within an hour who started her on the abortion pill reversal medication. And she delivered a healthy baby in mid-September. So when they say it's junk science or quack doctors, well, the facts are, 129 babies have been born after their mothers took this reversal medication. So once again, is this about selling abortions? Is it about promoting abortions? Or is it about giving women all the facts, giving them a choice, and then letting women decide what they want to do?
So in this case, are you thinking that doctors have overreacted?
Absolutely, they've overreacted. And it's because they're about promoting abortion. They're not about really giving women choices and doing what's best for women. So, you know, what is more tragic than a woman who starts down the path of having an abortion and either isn't given all the information she needs, the gestational age of her preborn child, the risk of the procedure, or that the abortion pill might be reversible, only later to find out that abortion may have been reversible?
I don't want to bog us down, but you're saying that all the doctors who came out against this are pro-abortion.
No, well, okay, we can get into what's pro-choice and what's pro-abortion.
Right.
But the doctors who are raising questions about this, I would encourage them to take a deep breath and to look at, women have taken the reversal medication. They have given birth to healthy children. Why not let women have this information?
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with the president of the Center for Arizona Policy, Kathy Herod. Kathy, there are some, and you kind of alluded to this, that they perceive that the Center for Arizona Policy, even with the work you've done, has actually been negative for Arizona. And I wonder how you feel about that, and whether that comes down to a commerce issue, because we have a lot of business leaders who will say, oh, something like SB 1062, look what that's done to Arizona, it's hurt it. Do you see that as hurting, or do you see it as actually opening people up?
Well, I appreciate the question, because one of my frustrations in that battle is how many people really sit down to look at what 1062 was about, to look at what our organization is about. And Senate Bill 1062 was a really simple bill. And if you've read it, you would know that. You know, if people just sit down and read it, they would know that. It was simply to update our Religious Freedom Restoration Act to put it in line with federal case law and with case law from other states. So the issue here is, should Arizonans, Americans, be free to live and work according to their faith? Our First Amendment guarantees the right to freely exercise our religious beliefs, really, or to exercise no belief. It's to freely exercise our beliefs, to have free association. So in many ways, Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, it's a balancing test, and I won't get into all the legal weeds, but it's not a done deal in court. It simply gives you your day in court. So I would kind of posit the reverse, that shouldn't Arizona be a state that welcomes people of all faith or no faith, and that Arizona is a state where you're free to live and work according to your faith or according to your beliefs. It wasn't going to hurt business. So it really was a small minority being able to grasp an issue, get the media on their side, and run with it.
So it was not anti-gay legislation?
No, not at all. It was pro-religious freedom, pro-freedom. And with the ongoing debate that's going to really escalate on religious freedom, I would encourage people to see the debate over religious freedom as a debate for freedom. Regardless of whether you are on a faith basis, the fight for religious freedom impacts freedom for all.
Kathy, let's move on to, I think, more general terms and whatnot. As we move on to what the influence the CAP has had at the state legislature, do you think that is a positive influence? Because some people will say, we come back to separation of church and state, and some will say that many of the things you're advocating for have to do with religion, and do we need to have that as intertwined in government?
Well, it's always a positive to have citizens involved in the democratic process. That's how our system is designed. And so if we want to have a voice for our views, for what we think public policy should be, then we better be involved at the state legislature. So, of course, I think it's a positive, and that this is every issue that we address. Yes, we are an evangelical Christian organization, and I don't back away from that one bit. But every issue that we address, we have sound public policy arguments for the positions that we take. Even on the marriage issue, it was marriage between a man and a woman that benefited society. I mean, we could go on and on. School choice gives parents the right to choose the education best for their children. I mean, every issue we address, that there's social science data to back up our position. So it's really the public policy debate that we're engaged in, not simply a debate about our religious beliefs or trying to bring our religious beliefs into the public policy debate.
I do want to mention, though, what critics will say again, which is that what you're doing is obviously above board. You're able to go down there and lobby as much as you want. But some people will say that the beliefs you have are not necessarily the beliefs that everyone has to have. And there's the feeling that, based on some of the legislation you support, that in fact you're saying that. You're not saying that you want everyone to have freedom. You're saying that it should sort of start with this Judeo-Christian point of view.
Well, and I would encourage people, take a look at the legislation, take a look at the laws, because that's just simply, you know, sometimes people, they try to go, okay, what argument might work and what argument might be used to smear a certain point of view? Take a look at the facts. Don't just believe what you see in certain segments of the media, but take a look at the facts and the reasonableness, the common sense approach that we have to every issue that we're addressing.
Kathy, what do you think about the job that Governor Doug Ducey has done so far?
Well, Governor Ducey is doing a good job. He's got a lot of challenges. Certainly, the number of children in foster care is a critical need for our state. What happens with education funding? There are a lot of significant issues facing our state. So I think, you know, he's in the first, 8 months of his term, 9 months of his term, something like that. So there's a lot to grasp, and I look forward to seeing what he's going to do over the next 3.5 years.
I don't want to make a blanket statement about this, but it does seem like he has called on faith-based organizations to help children once they are born. I mean, he has certainly called himself pro-life, and certainly seems like he has supported legislation to indicate that. But he's also said that once a child is born, especially, you mentioned, with the number of foster kids, that faith-based groups and all of us need to do a better job of that. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I was part of, during the Brewer administration, of an effort that Governor Brewer had called Arizona Serves, that I was on the task force that Governor Brewer had that was calling on the faith-based community. As one who is a believer and tries to follow God's word is clear that we're to take care of the orphans and the widows. And certainly that within the faith-based community, we need to be stepping up and being the ones to be certified as foster parents, helping those who want to be foster parents. How do we support them within our church worlds and that type of thing? So I think there is a critical need. And, you know, it's not an either-or situation. And that's what it often comes down to, either-or. No, it's a both-and. So we protect the preborn and we protect children once they're born.
Kathy, finally, can you give us a preview of what's coming in January? What is the Center for Arizona Policy looking to do?
Well, obviously, Planned Parenthood is an issue. We want to make sure that baby body parts are not being sold or traded in our state in any way. So I think strengthening, Governor Ducey did an emergency rule to that effect, but we'll be looking at that, strengthening that, and just seeing what else is on the horizon. I'll talk about it in January is what I usually say.
Center for Arizona Policy President Kathy Herod, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll meet the new president of the Phoenix Final Four, and we'll also talk about the Book of Mormon coming to the Valley. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Universal Pictures, presenting Steve Jobs, the new film from the screenwriter of The Social Network and the director of Slumdog Millionaire, now playing everywhere.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now with Steve Goldstein on 91.5 FM. We're also streaming live on the free mobile app. Checking traffic on the US 60 westbound at I-10, the HOV lane is blocked by a crash. Use caution in that area or find an alternate route. And thanks to all the members who made the News and Journalism Member Drive a success, we heard from 616 listeners who became members. Your support makes possible the high-quality public service you expect. If you didn't have the opportunity to make your gift of support, you can still do so at kjzz.org, and thank you. We should see a high of 79 today with a 60% chance of showers and storms throughout the valley. Tonight, partly cloudy, slight chance of showers, and a low of 64. Right now in Phoenix, partly sunny skies and 70 degrees. At 11:26.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Just talked with the president of the Center for Arizona Policy, Kathy Herod, one of the more influential organizations at the state capitol. Now I'm joined for a few minutes by Assistant Minority Leader Steve Farley. Steve, how are you? Steve, good morning. How are you?
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me now?
I can. Thank you.
Very good.
So let's talk about it first in more general sense. There are people who, when they hear the word lobbyist, they get a little bit nervous. And I'm wondering, in general, do you think there are organizations that have too much influence at the state capitol?
Oh, there are certainly those that have too much influence. Part of that is because we have districts that are so heavily in favor of certain parties, the ruling party here. That parties, that lobbyists that represent beliefs that the primary voters of the Republican Party feel are strong, or are strong things they make decisions about, have an outsized influence here on people. Certainly, Kathy Herod is one of those folks who has really made the legislature bend to her will in many ways, and I'm not sure that her will, despite what she was saying, has a lot to do with public policy, but more to do with fundraising for her own organization.
Steve, I wonder about that in general, though. When certainly lawmakers, I've heard people say this recently, that if we want to blame the legislature for things, sometimes we don't want to blame the legislature, or we do, and we don't blame ourselves for voting for certain people. How much pressure is there on legislators to follow folks like Kathy Herod? And is it, I mean, again, one would wonder if, in fact, we're saying that some groups are too influential, can't lawmakers just say no?
Oh, they certainly can say no, and they should be saying no. My attitude is that this job isn't important enough to me to sell out my principles for it. So I do what I believe is right for my constituents and the people of Arizona. And I think there are a lot of my colleagues who do the same thing, and that basically means that lobbyists don't matter to some of the core issues. Where lobbyists become very important is to issues that aren't necessarily core issues to us, where there are two sides of the issue, and then you can end up with lobbyists arguing one side or arguing the other, and because they're in your office every day the way citizens can't be, you develop a relationship with lobbyists that can influence how you are affected by certain bills unless you are willing to go do the homework yourself.
Yeah, Steve, are lawmakers targeted by certain lobbyists, certain groups, because they know they will be friendly?
Yeah, there are certain people who are more willing than others to listen to certain things. I think in general, though, most people are trying to figure out up here what they think is best for the constituents that they serve. But really, there are a lot of things we deal with that aren't issues that our constituents really care that much about unless they're very specific. We spend a lot of time talking about things like the a pest control bill of how you can argue between two different types of factions within the pest control industry. And most people aren't really tuned in on that. So consequently, we need more information, and the information is being given us by people from one side or another. I like to hear from both sides, but there may be legislators who only trust one certain lobbyist, and that lobbyist is being paid by one side of the issue, and then they get their influence. And that's part of how certain lobbyists get certain high prices to be able to get that influence.
And Steve, let's talk a little bit more specifically about the Center for Arizona Policy. I asked Kathy Herod this question about the perception of the state, whether bills that the CAP has brought forward have hurt the perception of the state. Do you think it has?
Oh, they certainly have. And despite her claiming that it's good public policy, which she's advocating, there's some things that are very specifically bad public policy. Just recently, they approved a bill that she was pushing for that forces the state to put on their official website the instructions for how to refer people to basically a person that in my mind is a quack who claims that you can reverse abortions. That has not been medically proven. It's been denied by a whole lot of people and actually puts at risk for birth defects if people try to carry through for that. And yet, and a court actually just ruled that has to be stayed because it's not actually accurate information, and forcing physicians to say that abortion can be reversed is actually a violation of their First Amendment rights by forcing them to say something that's wrong. You see a lot of that stuff coming out of Kathy Herod and her group, which doesn't have anything to do with good public policy, but actually makes us look terrible. And the more she pushes this whole effort, what she calls a Religious Freedom Act, that it's actually the Freedom to Discriminate Act, the worse we look nationally. And it's only by the grace of God that we didn't pass SB 1062 a couple of years ago, and end up taking the heat that Indiana has gotten nationally for that. We really have to be aware that when you go out publicly, like Indiana actually did, and thank goodness Jan Brewer vetoed it, and say that businesses should have the right to discriminate against gay and lesbian people, then you're going to get some blowback, and deservedly so. So let's hope that the next session we don't end up with another SB 1062 coming through and having devastating effects on our state simply because Kathy Herod wants to raise more money for her organization.
State Senator Steve Farley is the assistant minority leader in that body. Steve, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Valley hosted the Super Bowl earlier this year. Early next year, this will be the place for college football's national championship game. Then in the spring of 2017, the University of Phoenix Stadium will be the site for the NCAA Men's Basketball Final Four. It's the first time a Western city has hosted the Final Four since 1995. Earlier this week, Don Rogers was named the executive director and CEO of the 2017 Phoenix NCAA Basketball Final Four. Now, Don, for some of us, 2017 sounds far away, but when it comes to preparation for an event like this, it probably doesn't sound like enough time. Why does the process need to start this early?
Honestly, we began the process in November when we found out that we had been awarded the bid. And we're 17 months away, which it does seem like a nice amount of time, but in fact, in a few weeks, we'll be unveiling the logo for the Phoenix Final Four. We're working on our legacy projects right now, trying to map out what parts of our community we're going to be able to, you know, we're going to be able to just serve through those legacy projects. And we're putting together our board and our subcommittee structure. So starting now really gives us the time to plan the impact of what we'd like to have across the valley, the people that are going to be involved, and also gives us a chance to start the fundraising efforts for this event. So while 17 months seems like a lot of time, there are days that I really become actually a little bit anxious already with all the planning that we have to do.
Okay. The Valley has developed a great reputation for hosting major events. Obviously, the Final Four falls into that category. What are some of the qualities you think really stand out that make this a place that is attracting these events?
I think first and foremost, we have a tremendous tourism industry here. And when groups come to tour, as the NCAA did, I think they are overwhelmed with just how gracious our community is, how much they want to host events, and exactly what they're willing to do for the fans that come here to enjoy the events. And I have been struck by that sense of community that spans from, you know, Mesa through Tempe and Phoenix and into Glendale, at the camaraderie and the willingness to work together to bring the events here. And I think it's really unique when you look at the small number of cities that can actually host an event like the Final Four. I think it's unique, and it's refreshing to have a community that works so well together.
And once the sites are selected for these events, is there a collaboration that goes on with cities that have hosted it before, cities that are hosting it again? Obviously, in the bidding process, there's a lot of competition, but once a bid is awarded, do these cities come together and say, hey, let me give you a tip on that or a tip on that?
They really do, and I can't say enough. We were in Indianapolis this past year for the Final Four. They've hosted 7 men's Final Fours as well as many women's Final Fours. And they are very collaborative and open. And I'll be traveling to Houston later in November to attend their monthly LOC meeting. Doug Hall and his staff have been very open and collaborative. And I think, again, there's such a small number of cities that meet the specifications to host a Final Four, that there is this willingness to work together to have an outstanding event every year. You know, we are shepherds for this event. It's iconic. It's the one of the NCAA's 89 championship events, but it's really one of their largest platforms to be able to talk about student athletes and what the membership is able to do, to help student athletes grow and develop and be educated. And so the cities work together. We work very closely with the NCAA as well, so this remains a signature event.
And Dawn, how does it work in terms of who gets to, I say gets to, but who attends the games? Because I think there's some who will say, I mean, I'm someone who's lived in Phoenix most of my life and grew up as a Suns fan, and I follow ASU and U of A, but this hasn't been as much of a college basketball town per se as some other ones. Does that play into it at all, or is this just because it's such a huge event, there are going to be fans from all over? It's not really about what the local audience really wants?
Well, I think one of the reasons that we're so excited to host the event here, and if I can put on my Arizona State hat,
of course,
is, you know, to grow that collegiate basketball culture. I mean, we have, you know, we're blessed to have so many teams here, so many fans from around the country. And it's fun for me when we would have games at Arizona State just to watch the fans, especially from Midwestern teams that would come in, you know, come to the event, because there, you know, there's a culture of collegiate basketball across the country. And so the fact of the matter is the vast majority of people that will attend the games, that will be ticketed patrons, are going to come from outside the state. If you look at the breakdown of the people that go into the lottery, that win tickets, the fans of the 4 participating institutions, all the athletic directors across the country have the opportunity, every member institution has the opportunity to purchase tickets. So really the makeup of the fan base is going to be from across the country. But I think for our fans here to be able to really taste and see what goes into, it's an event unlike any event that we've hosted here, simply because you have 4 teams coming to the championship site. And that Saturday where you have the semifinal games, I've had a couple people ask, you know, well, gosh, you go into that, you know, you go into University of Phoenix Stadium and it's so big, and how do you even follow the game on the court? And, you know, it, and the experience of being there with the fans of the 4 teams and watching, you know, feeling the whole atmosphere is very unique. And I've been to, national championship football games. I've been to the Rose Bowl every year, amazing events. And this one just has a different, unique feel to it that's really tremendous to experience.
Dunn, you mentioned being a little anxious occasionally. You also mentioned fundraising. One final sort of logistical question for you. Is there one thing that seems like the biggest challenge that when that is accomplished, then the feeling is more, okay, now we're sort of planning for the event as opposed to the things around the event?
That's a great question. I don't think that until we're actually done with the games will I kind of feel like, okay, we're on the home stretch because there's so many different moving pieces. But I will feel, better when we've established our budget, when we know the things that we want to do here in our community. So if we want to do additional legacy projects, those are things that we're going to have to raise money for. And so I'll feel a little bit better when we have our budget established and, when we have those first, major individuals, corporations, foundations that commit to us. I think people are excited to become involved, but we haven't actually gone out in the community and, solidified, that first gift, to the local organizing committee, and I'll feel better when we do that.
And Dawn, finally, with March Madness, of course, being the key, but the dates of the games are April 1st and April 3rd. How are we going to manage that?
Well, March Madness is the beginning of the tournament and the four weekends that go into. So you start with the college basketball conference tournaments around the country, and then you move, to that, the first four, and then, those 32 games that happen on that first weekend, you move to Sweet 16, and then you go on to the Final Four. So it's really that whole month that you put together with all the games collectively, with the road ending here in Phoenix and those four teams that come in, to experience our great hospitality. So it is truly a month of madness that we're really excited to be part of.
And since we're talking about a year and a half away with Bobby Hurley, the new ASU coach, and of course U of A with their history, what do you think the chances are one of those teams makes the Final Four?
It would be tremendous to have Arizona State or U of A. I'm cheering for, of course, all the Pac-12 teams. I'd love to have the West represented in that event. And so I'll be cheering hard for, for both of those programs to have, to be represented here in their home state.
Dawn Rogers, this week she was named the executive director and CEO of the 2017 Phoenix NCAA Basketball Final Four. Dawn, thanks so much for the time. Take care.
Thank you.
And still to come, we'll hear about the life and career of the late Jack Feaster. We'll also find out about the Book of Mormon finally coming to the Valley. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Peoria Subaru, offering a selection of new AWD vehicles, including the 2016 Subaru Forester, Outback, Legacy, and more. Locally owned and operated for 25 years by the Moore family. Online at PeoriaSubaru.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and online at KJZZ.org. In traffic on the US 60 westbound at I-10, a crash is blocking the HOV lane. And a special thank you to our Leadership Society members, Mr. Keith and Mrs. Elaine Christian, for their generous support in bringing programs like Here and Now and All Things Considered to KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8257. Showers and storms are likely throughout the valley. We should reach a high of 79. Tonight, slight chance of showers with a low in the mid-60s. Tomorrow, expect a high of 82. In Phoenix, with 60% humidity and partly cloudy skies, it's 70 degrees at 11:43.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. For a number of years, the narrative has been that Arizona simply doesn't have enough leadership, or at least nonpartisan big picture leadership. Where are the people who care less about ideology and ego and more about putting the state on a future track that makes sense? One important person from the state's recent history who actually did that, primarily behind the scenes, was Jack Feaster. He was the chief executive of SRP for 15 years and an advisor to elected leaders, both Republicans and Democrats. Feaster is the subject of a new book, Water, Power, and Persuasion, How Jack Feaster Shaped Modern Arizona. Its author is former Arizona Republic editorial writer and award-winning journalist Kathleen Ingley. She joins me now, as does Jack Feaster's daughter, Suzanne, currently president and CEO of St. Luke's Health Initiatives. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Steve.
So, Kathleen, a lot of research went into this, 80 interviews at least. What are a couple of real surprising things that even you didn't know about Jack Feaster?
I really had no idea that he was so involved in dealing with the aftermath of the Three Mile Island nuclear accident, which was a moment where nuclear power in Arizona was in the entire United States was actually in jeopardy. People were terrified by this accident. And the industry realized that they needed to respond. And meanwhile, of course, there was a presidential commission looking at it, and Governor Babbitt was on that. Jack became involved in the industry's effort to figure out what could they do to keep the industry alive. Mm-hmm. And he worked back channels with Bruce Babbitt, which was a way Jack often operated. He often got a lot done not by being out front, by working in behind the scenes. And in this case, he worked out an idea. I think a lot of it came from Jack, because Jack was always very solutions-oriented, for an industry institute that would teach, have training for people who worked in nuclear power plants, and that would have teams available to offer technical assistance. It was, it's hard to believe now that something as important as nuclear power, there just was no central way to have people educated and to deal with lessons learned, which was, by the way, another theme of Jack, lessons learned. He was always looking for lessons learned. So he was instrumental in getting this put together, and then, since he was working with Governor Babbitt, getting this worked into the overall solution. And nationally, this actually became a model for how industry can, I hate to say self-regulation, because sometimes that's a very bad word, but there is a place for self-regulation when you're talking about, say, training, and this became a national model.
Suzanne, the behind-the-scenes aspect of things comes up to me because there are a lot of people who work behind the scenes and yet still work behind the scenes to see what sort of advantage they can get. When you think about where your dad got this, being born, he was born in Prescott. He grew up there was a very small area at that point. Mm-hmm. What was in sort of the family work ethic or something that made him want to do this in a way that really seems to be, again, we emphasize nonpartisanship?
I'm a fourth generation Arizonan, and the first generation came in 1882, and he was a territorial marshal. So the sense of community service really goes back in our family generations. And there was a county attorney in there. My great uncle was the head of the highway commission in the 50s and 60s. And so Dad grew up in this sense of service, and we joke about it. My grandmother dated Barry Goldwater in high school, and so when he was a U.S. senator, he would come by and stop by my dad's house to pay his respects. So all along the way, Dad knew this sense of, and really this sense of being a servant leader, really came generations from our Arizona roots.
Kathleen, I'm not sure you're as cynical a journalist as I am, but it's funny. Sometimes the phrase public service for some people means, you know, serving at the trough for yourself, and it seems like Jack was not that. Did it seem unique as you did more research that it really seemed like he was, I mean, again, I'm being more cynical on this, but he does seem like someone who was not in it. He really meant public service. I mean, he was really about serving the state.
Yes, he passionately loved Arizona, and doing civic service seemed to become a hobby for him. He really genuinely enjoyed, I think, problem solving. He genuinely enjoyed finding compromise, and his list of accomplishments and the number of issues he was involved in, I think, is just extraordinary.
And one that came up a lot in the book, and I have to admit, even though I thought I was very familiar with the history of the Martin Luther King Day and all that went into that, how much influence he had on that finally becoming a holiday here.
Yes. The Martin Luther King Day, for people who don't know, had been declared a holiday by Governor Babbitt. Governor Meekham came into office pledging to get rid of it, which he did. Arizona became an instant pariah. there was an election, but unfortunately there were two competing ballot propositions, which is usually a guarantee of failure. And so it went down. Arizona was losing business and conventions right and left. And that's when Jack became involved. He helped pull together the business community, which really was sort of hang back. And in a campaign called Victory Together, there was a pastor, Warren Stewart, who was kind of a firebrand, and he was heading it up. And Jack was particularly important because the business community was very suspicious, and they didn't trust this guy. And Jack went and he talked to people and said, you need to get behind him, and we need to put our money into this. And Jack was involved in putting together a strategy that was very, very Jack-like, very low-key. They decide, we already had the big publicity. Let's not have a big public fight over this. Let's quietly gather support. Let's make it a grassroots effort. And it paid off. And there are people who say that Jack is one of the unacknowledged people that was part of the glue that held it together. Mm.
Suzanne, you're someone who's been involved in public policy. You're very much involved in public life as well. Do you feel like the influence your dad has is still lingering? Did he have coattails? Because there are people who just wonder about where is that nonpartisan leadership? Where did it go? Did it disappear with a Jack Feaster?
I don't think so. He's been gone more than 6 years, and I still have people come up to me and say, your father changed my life. And I'm like, and you are. I mean, it's just he had an extraordinary reach. And I still, to this day, I had another, someone emailed me and said, I use the Feasterisms, because there were many of them. And he said, I still believe in that, and I still use that. So I continue to get reminiscences. And we've established a website, jackfeaster.com. And I would encourage anybody who's listening who has their own story to share that. There's a place on there for videos and for emails. And because it just continues to have that impact. I walked with Dad and marched with Dad for the MLK before it was a holiday. And we did that many years together. And so I really understood, and I feel the legacy of my generations of the continuing commitment. So I hope and my family members are continuing to live out that legacy that Dad really exemplified.
Kathleen, just a minute or so left, and what comes to mind for me is this idea about not caring who gets the credit. You wrote about that recently, a little bit on My Turn in the Arizona Republic. Does that stand out as one of the real shining aspects of Jack Feaster?
Yes. He was very interested in getting things done and spreading the credit and pulling people in. And he didn't care if his name was associated with something or not. And it was a can-do spirit. And I think that's also how you get people to work together, how you pull is if they know that you're not doing it for one person, you're doing it for a cause.
Kathleen Ingley is the author of the new book, Water, Power, and Persuasion, How Jack Feaster Shaped Modern Arizona. Jack Feaster's daughter, Suzanne, also here. She's currently president and CEO of St. Luke's Health Initiatives. Thank you both.
Thank you, Steve.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The wildly popular musical The Book of Mormon has just opened in the Valley this week. It was critically acclaimed, and fans were impatiently awaiting its arrival. Despite its popularity, the show has also been very controversial. Some have wondered whether it makes fun of Mormons in an affectionate or disrespectful way. Is it okay to laugh at another person's faith? With me for a few minutes to talk about the Book of Mormon, the musical, is Holly Welker. She's editing a collection of writings about the musical, which includes a chapter she wrote about there not being any parts for white women in the musical. Holly, thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Holly, let's start with that. What does that reflect to you, this idea that basically there are men in drag playing the parts that could have gone to white women?
Well, that's actually a very small part of my chapter. Mm-hmm. I'm more concerned with gender overall. But one of the things I think it reflects is the fact that women are not necessary to tell an authentic story about Mormonism and more specifically Mormon missionaries.
And what does that reflect about what the creators had in mind, do you think, about the play?
Well, I think part of it is that they went for what was easy. The look of the Mormon missionary, the white shirt, the dark tie, dark slacks, is so common that it actually represents a kind of missionary spirit across Christianity. It doesn't just have to be Mormon. So introducing women, and I myself was a missionary for the church, who can't have a broader range of what they can wear, who are not as commonly seen, just confuses the matter.
So I wonder, the fact that you have gone through this, you've been on a mission, when you've seen the play?
Yes.
More than once or just?
I saw it once on Broadway. Yeah. I've listened to the soundtrack repeatedly. I have tickets for this engagement here.
What would you say to friends, relatives who are still practicing Mormons about whether they should see it? Are there certain questions they would need to ask themselves before they went to see it?
How comfortable are they with blasphemy? I think the real problem is not the depiction of Mormons, because the depiction, for instance, of Africans is also extremely problematic. They are presented as very credulous, not especially curious. A very simplistic, stereotypical view of Africans. To me, the real problem is the blasphemy, that it's one thing to see someone poke fun at you. It's another to hear a song that celebrates sodomizing God in a variety of orifices, okay, which is what one of the songs does.
So is there a danger? I guess I'm wondering here whether we can't read the creators' minds, but I'm wondering if there's this idea that said, oh, let's do what we consider to be a funny musical about Mormonism, which includes some accurate things and some over the top, and then it becomes sort of sophomoric, and then it sort of loses its touch. Based on what you're saying about that particular song, it sounds as if, well, we started off on one track and then decided, hey, we can do whatever we want.
Well, it's the guys from South Park. I think they decided long ago that they can do whatever they want. I loved the musical. I found it moving. I found it interesting. That did not prevent me from recognizing its limitations. Mm. I felt that it did an extremely good job of portraying certain aspects of missionary life and did so in ways that were moving and interesting and authentic. But there were these other aspects, the fuller range of Mormon life, Mormon family life, relationships, Mormon relationships involving women, the relationships of missionaries to the people they teach, that wasn't done so well.
I don't know if there's any way to quantify this, but based on what we know about the popularity of the musical, do you think it's been influential in certain ways? Do you think it's perhaps made some people want to learn more about Mormonism?
I know that it has. Mm-hmm. I know that there have been performances, in particular one in Rochester, where they had a poster of Mormon missionaries with a cutout where people could put their faces in and have a picture taken if they filled out a card saying that they were interested in getting a Book of Mormon or hearing a little more about it. And I know that the better part of 1,000 people did that. I don't know whether or not there have been any baptisms, but I know that it has also made life easier for people who want to write about Mormons, because it makes certain things about the culture more accessible, more understandable. I think overall it has been a good thing for Mormons.
Where do we draw the line when it comes to whether it's okay to laugh about someone's faith? You sort of alluded to this before, and whether we're laughing at them as if there aren't odd things in what any of us believes, is it okay to make it sort of like, ah, now it's okay to laugh at this group? Or does there need to be that affectionate aspect to it as well? Sort of, okay, I'm laughing at you, but, you know, you can also laugh at me as well.
Well, the big question of, is it okay? I mean, people do it.
Right.
It's simply done. People mock others in ways that are both kind and cruel.
But does it some ways make us more of a collective society, or is it a dividing line? Is it one of those things where we can all laugh at ourselves, or wait a second?
Well, that's it. It is certainly, I think, better to be generous and affectionate in your mocking of others than to just be simply mean. Mm-hmm. So,
Holly, finally, do you expect there to be protests? Do you expect people, when they go to Gamage, to just enjoy themselves?
I would expect that they would just enjoy themselves. Who has time at this point to protest something? It premiered in the spring of 2011. I would say that at this point, probably the controversy is a little bit settled.
And finally, just in a few seconds, you think this is a market that will react as any other market has reacted to the Book of Mormon?
Well, considering that it's playing for over 2 weeks and most of the shows are sold out, I would say that probably, yes, the market will react the way others have.
Holly Welker is co-editing a collection of scholarly essays on the Book of Mormon musical. Its working title is The Book Will Change Your Life. She's also the editor of Bearing Witness, 36 Mormon Women Talk Candidly About Love, Sex, and Marriage, which is coming out next year. Holly, thanks so much.
It has been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Tiara Vian for their help on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. If you missed any part of this program, you can catch it online later this afternoon at kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. NPR's Here and Now is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix in HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, where cancer specialists work together to provide personalized care right here in Metro Phoenix. More at mayoclinic.org/cancer.